Hi, this is Larry Jordan, the host of the Digital Production Buzz. The following interview was recorded at the Anderson Ranch Arts Center in Aspen, Colorado, as part of our coverage of the intersection between arts and technology. For more information about the Digital Production Buzz, visit digitalproductionbuzz.com. One of the things I find fascinating about the Anderson Ranch Arts Center is the variety of different artists on campus, from sculpture and ceramics to painting and printmaking. Which gets me to my next guest. David Ellsworth is a studio artist at Ellsworth Studios in rural Pennsylvania. He's a woodturner, the past president of the American Association of Woodturners, and its first honorary life member. His work is in museums and private collections all over the world. Now, while you may not think woodturning has any relevance to filmmaking, there is one big common area: creativity and a creative process. And this is what I want to talk with David about. As you listen, discover how the creative process David uses in his art also applies to our creative projects as well. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me.
You know, first, describe what you do so people get a picture in their mind of what it is that you're doing when you're working in your studio.
I'm affectionately referred to as a wooden potter. By that, what I mean is that I can hollow out a solid block of wood through a small opening in the top to gain a consistent wall thickness that's fairly thin. And when you pick the objects up from a visual outside perspective, they look like ceramic pots. Once you pick them up and realize they're wood, there's a sense of magic to them because you know they've been hollowed out in a mysterious way as opposed to formed the way one would in clay.
Now, whatever led you to this path?
I had undergraduate work about 2 years in ceramics en route to getting a degree in sculpture. And as I was working in my own studio, I kind of got tired of making production bowls, open bowls. And they started creeping, the rims started creeping smaller and smaller and closer together. And then I started thinking about the relationship of vessel forms to ceramics. And that isolated me from then on. So I've been terminally unemployable ever since.
Perhaps unemployable, but I've seen slides of some of your work, and it's breathtaking in how it looks.
Thank you.
Things that I like about it is how you bring out texture in the wood. How do you look at wood to find the texture that's in it?
Let me make some references back and forth between wood and clay, because all wooden forms come or have been represented in clay at some point in the past by some culture. And in clay, you have a large, broad range of color textures and patterns and et cetera through the glazes and the body of the clay. Wood brings its own decoration to it through the grain structure, the color, and the patterns from which it comes from different areas within a tree, whether it be a root or the trunk or a burl or a crotch or whatever. What I'm trying to do in wood turning is to consider the vessel form as a foundational element and then grow from there. And that could mean texture, it could mean color, it might mean imposing a texture onto the material or certain species of material, which would happen if you're burning it or sandblasting it. I try not to push beyond the native or natural element of the material to make it look like clay. That's not my intent. My intent is to bring out the richness of the material in as broad a variety as possible. Ranges of expression, for instance. Ash is a wonderful material because it's quite versatile. I can sandblast it. I can burn it. I can polish it and oil it. I can leave it straight off the gouge. And it all in that range. It has a wonderful breadth of interest and visual power to it. If I'm looking at spalted maple, which is basically decomposed wood, I can represent that as a smooth surface, but most likely as a raw surface. So I like to represent it as much in the raw as possible. So I get a muted, almost a sandpaper-like, if you wish, a raku surface in wood, which is similar to raku and clay in terms of textural. I think that the vessel concept in all the different media is a very intimate process during the making process.
How so?
Well, the human vessel, of course, is the ultimate vessel, and we are reasonably intimate ourselves. But as you bring in other materials, and begin to work with them, the process itself of working with a given material, for independent of what that material is an expression of what's going on in you at that given moment.
Is it really that personal? I mean, you're just trying to carve a circle, aren't you?
Well, you could think about it as impersonal if you're doing production work, for instance. Production work indicates that you're fundamentally doing repeats of the same thing. You've come across a design that's very satisfactory to you. You're making for the market, if you wish, which is quite clearly what you're, why you're doing it, to sell the work. What I'm doing in making one-of-a-kind objects is exploring myself through the process in the object so that when I get done with the object, if it doesn't give something back to me, then I know there's something either dead about it, or maybe I was too concerned about something other than the relationship I had with it while I was making it. Something just doesn't click. That's the one that finds its way to the wood stove. But it may take a while to figure out why it's not giving me the energy back. And vessel forms to me are about energy. If I think of a boat, which is a vessel, I think about the person who made the boat and the person who's using the boat. They are, to me, one and the same. If the craftsmanship of the maker is in the boat, hopefully the person who's using the boat will respect that, understand it in some form by the performance of the boat, the feel of the boat, and fundamentally, if you wish, even the rib cage of the boat. If I'm making a vessel form, call it on the lathe, and I get done with it, and I've had a satisfying experience in making it, then I have a feeling that it's going to give back something to me, but it takes some time to be assured that that's in fact going to happen. That's the intimacy I'm considering.
We see this a lot, I think, in handcrafted materials, where
Absolutely.
Someone is handcrafting skis or handcrafting snowboards, that there's a difference between that and something which is manufactured the same way over and over again. Is that an analogy to what you're talking about here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that in a broader perspective, if we look at the different media going on today in different craft schools, different, you know, and market arenas, if we look at our educational system and what's going on there, we can project in the future that we're going to fundamentally produce a whole bunch of people that don't know what a screwdriver is from a wrench, or how to manipulate objects with their hands, materials, if you wish, with their hands. And I think that they're losing a great part of the growth process, the mental growth process, by not having that facility. So what we're trying to do in teaching, and what I'm trying to do in my own studio, is to illustrate the beauty of the process through the object that other people may are witnessing or coming to us through, and getting them involved in that making process so that they can enjoy that intimacy as well.
But there's a key word you keep saying. You keep saying process. It's like you're not as much interested in the end result as in how the end result is created.
I think in the long haul, they're about the same.
How so?
Because if you don't have the value of the process, you can be led astray with the object that you make to become anything you want it to, in most cases, other than what it really is. There is a relationship between the maker, the process, and the object that is so intimate and so intertwined that if we look historically back at different makers who are known for making certain types of objects, what we see is maybe the market as to how it received those objects. Or maybe that market didn't receive that object very satisfactorily, meaning it didn't sell. But if you crawl below the market and find out how that object was made and who made it, you see a language going through all of that individual's work coming out in their work that is very different than the language of another maker in the same material and possibly even making similar forms.
Let's back up to the beginning of the process. And I want to reflect for a moment on the concept of creativity.
All right.
You're looking at a chunk of wood. Define that chunk in whatever size or shape you want. But how do you go through a creative process to decide what this chunk of wood is going to become? It's similar to, say, a filmmaker looking at a blank piece of paper and trying to decide a script, or a director trying to decide how to visualize words on a paper. How would you describe your creative process?
I would start by recognizing that throwing clay on a wheel, turning wood on a lathe, blowing glass on a punty stick is a centering process.
Centering meaning what?
A centering meaning you are allowing your entire being to focus on one element at a given time, period of time, and that making process, manipulating that material in however it is done, is a way of bringing your entire being into that energy source at that moment. So if I'm beating something, it's going to take very, very long period of time. If I'm throwing clay, the object comes up and it becomes a vessel form. If I'm turning wood, it does a similar thing. But during the period of time that I'm making that object, I am centered on that. How should I say? I'm centered on that process. I don't mean to overuse the term, but I'm focused directly on what I'm doing at that moment. And that's what's bringing things out of me that I have no direct consciousness with, no intent, if you wish, but just allowing it to happen as it happens.
But you're describing the process of creativity as the process of putting it on the lathe and starting to do something to it. Do you actually look at a piece of wood and think for a moment before you start to do things to it what it could become?
Yes.
How does the thinking go before you physically touch the wood?
Backing up from that but going to that, I think it also is a measure of self-discovery. Well, I remember years ago when Wendell Castle made a statement during a lecture in Seattle when someone asked him, what did he think about when he was designing something? Did he know what he was going to come up with when he finished? And he says, I don't want to know what I'm going to come up with before I start, because it gets in the way of the creative process. In my case, I'm looking at a log. My experience and familiarity with that particular material or that particular location of the log is going to indicate that I might be able to make this particular style of design, if you wish. What I do then is I begin to remove the material on that object that I know I don't want. That's a bit of a subjective statement, but it means that I might get rid of the root area, for instance, in order to get to a different portion of the grain. And as I'm eliminating something, I'm actually learning from what's left. And those become keys to me as to the flow of the process that's going to come about during the making process of that vessel form.
So each discovery as you move forward builds on what you've discovered so far.
Indeed.
But you have a basic idea that I'm going to build a vole or I'm going to build a stacking object, because you have to start with a particular shape for each of these.
Correct.
So you have a general goal in mind, but you're allowing yourself the freedom along that journey to create the bowl of changing the shape or the size or the texture?
Correct again, and it could be height, diameter, breadth, whatever it might be. The exciting part is that you form a repertory of your own forms, your own styles, if you wish, and then something happens during the making process that takes you into another direction, and you have to give yourself the freedom to go in that direction, because you never know where it's going to lead you. It could be as subtle as a 16th of an inch off the belly of a form that changes the whole nature of the object and subsequently leads to a whole new body of work within that series.
Writers talk about this a lot when they refer to how a character changes as they're writing the character. They suddenly realize there's a personality quirk that they didn't realize that they can then build part of the plot structure on.
Exactly. And a painter, which has the facility, obviously, of speed, you know, in working as opposed to a sculptor carving stone. A painter has a great opportunity to apply the paint to the canvas or the sheet or the paper, whatever it might be, see if they like it, and then go from there. And it may lead very well into some whole new direction over a short period, or sometimes even a long period of time.
What do you say to students who are starting out who think they don't have any creativity? How do you find that creative spark inside yourself?
I think Joseph Campbell said during his interview with Bill Moyers that everyone is an artist. His theory was that if you're alive, you're a creative person. And I would agree with that in the broadest terms. I think that there's a lot of baggage this day and age to the term creativity or design, if you wish. And any culture at any time is going to layer on things that they can't understand or that become so labored by or enamored by that people are going to go in different directions according to the labels. I think that the creative process needs to be discovered within each of us. So what you're trying to do with your when you're working with students is give them the tools to discover that creative process within themselves, but don't necessarily use the term. The way I do it is I get them involved in a raw chunk of wood that they know they can't possibly process themselves on the lathe, and then show them safely how to work through it and it, with the different tools that we use. And then as they're doing that, encourage them by virtue of what they're accomplishing. And don't mention creativity until they get to the very end.
Sneak up on them,
exactly. I think you go through process stage by stage by stage by stage, and when you get done with the object, then you have your design. But if you start out trying to design something, a person can be totally helpless because there's too much that they don't know that won't get them to the ultimate design, the perfect design, the proper shape, whatever it might be.
Or they look at the work that you've done and say, look at what he's done. I can never achieve that. I should not even start.
Exactly. You have to figure out a way to sneak up behind them and kick them in the ass before they realize what's happened. And then suddenly they say, wow, I can do this. I can do this. I may not be able to do it well yet, but I can do this. And it's the success factor along the way that helps to build a good student.
So how do you overcome the fear of getting started, the fear that I can't be good enough? That to me is, I think, a real challenge for anybody starting out. That they look at perfection, they say, I can't achieve it. How do you get past that block?
Boy, there are so many different ways, and none of them are always the right way. As a teacher, it takes someone who's curious enough about their process of teaching and the students they're working with to remain a student themselves. As long as I remain a student myself, to my method and to my the individuals I'm working with, I'm going to discover something within them because I'm interested in them. I already know this. They don't. I'm interested in something that they have that they may not recognize. It may be the way they move or the lack of how they move. It may be some little key that they're stumbling on as they're making an object that says to me, I can build on that. Let me build on that. In my own school in Pennsylvania, where I have 5 students over a 3-day period, we serve 3 meals a day in our home during the course of the day so that there's no interruption to the flow of the learning process. And during those meals, this is when we really find people opening up about topics other than wood turning, which then lend themselves directly to wood turning, as I perceive it as an observer of their behavior. And I can tell how they're working on the machine. If they're high energy, hyper, you know, whatever it might be, they're going to go blasting through stuff. And I can very easily come over, put my hand on the tool and say, let's try it this way and see the difference. And suddenly these lights go off and say, wow, slow and steady wins the race after all. Or if they're very, very slow, which is most common for people who have no experience, then I can do the same thing. And I'll say, okay, let's feed it slowly across here this way. Now let's put a little more pressure here, a little slower pace and a slightly larger cut and see what happens. Suddenly they see these ribbons of shaving going off, and even though they know I'm guiding the tool for the first 1 or 2 cuts, they're holding it, they're guiding it, they're moving their body through it, and it becomes a built-upon process that way.
As you were starting your career as an artist, what was the best piece of advice you got?
The best piece of advice I got was I was studying architecture in Washington University as a 21-year-old freshman right out of the Army, and the design professor, Les Lasky, had a nude model in front of us and easels with charcoal, black charcoal, and 30-second to 1-minute poses. And at the end of the next week, he would call each student in, you see, and he'd do the classic professorial thing with the leather patches on his elbows and his hands behind his back, and he'd go around, look at all this stuff. And he came up to me and he looked at me and he says, why don't you get the hell out of architecture and go into the fine arts where you belong? So I did. I went to New York City. I quit Washington. I went to New York City to become an artist, went to the New School for Social Research for 4 years and loved it. And then after I finished my master's in sculpture in Colorado, I stumbled onto Paul Solner at the Anderson Ranch and suddenly got an artist working in clay, opening up a kiln, inviting his friends, paying for the monthly rent. I thought, this is really hot. To hell with the academia. I've been in that long enough. And I became infatuated with the making process from the ground up for buildings, wiring, plumbing, and everything. And making a living in a direct manner by making, taking it to the people, getting a response, going back, making some more. And then, of course, the classic thing is facing yourself in the mirror and finding out who you are. And all of us, of course, do that in one form or another as we go through life. So I got beat up a bit in the beginning, but when I had the clue from Lasky as to a direction that somebody else was recognizing that I respected, then I followed that lead and then began to discover myself through the arts. And I think this is what all people do who either succeed or are attempting to succeed through the creative process themselves.
David, I could talk to you for hours, but I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. This has been a treat.
David Ellsworth is a studio woodturner at works with Ellsworth Studios. And David, do you have a website people can go to see?
Yes, it's www.ellsworthstudios.com.
That's all one word, ellsworth studios.com. David, thanks for joining us today.
Indeed. Thanks, Larry.